Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on prevention and treatment of acute kidney injury in patients receiving high-dose methotrexate. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Anita Varghese and Dr. Shazia Nokata and Shruti Gupta discuss advancements in therapies to treat adult and pediatric patients with delayed methotrexate clearance due to impaired kidney function. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from SERB Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Gupta starts by discussing the latest updates in the management of high-dose methotrexate toxicity.
Thank you very much for the introduction. So my name is Dr. Shruti Gupta. I am Director of Onconephrology at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And I will be talking to you a little bit about some of our latest updates in the management of methotrexate AKI. These are my disclosures. Most relevant are that I do get some funding from BTG for research related to methotrexate AKI. Now, in terms of just some initial background on high-dose methotrexate and acute kidney injury, so we know that high-dose methotrexate remains the cornerstone of treatment for a number of important cancers, including lymphomas and leukemias involving the CNS, as well as osteosarcomas. Methotrexate, however, is associated with a number of toxicities, and acute kidney injury is among some of the most common and consequential. The incidence of AKI in these patients is a little bit hard to delineate because there's a lot of variability across studies in terms of how AKI is even defined. But suffice it to say that because methotrexate is this folate antagonist that inhibits this key enzyme dihydrofolate reductase that's needed for nucleic acid synthesis, that it's active against cells that divide very rapidly, and that includes both tumor cells as well as cells in the kidney, as well as in other organs as well. And that's why we see so many of these toxicities in these patients. And this is just a schematic that I made that kind of highlights one of the mechanisms by which patients can develop kidney injury. Basically, in the setting of an acidic pH, the methotrexate crystallizes in the kidney tubules, and that leads to obstruction and tubular cell damage. Now, these are some nice pictures that highlight what we find on histopathology and on urinary sediment in these patients. So the first image shows how methotrexate precipitates in the urine at an acidic pH. And the second is a representative image from a kidney biopsy specimen, and basically just shows that methotrexate AKI is characterized by this acute tubular injury that's very sort of pathognomonic with these scattered, almost intratubular needle-shaped golden brown crystals. And these actually show birefringence under polarized light. The reality is, though, that we rarely biopsy patients because it's usually quite clear temporally that there's this association between the exposure of methotrexate and the onset of AKI. So we often just make the diagnosis clinically without a biopsy. In terms of risk factors for methotrexate AKI, there have been some studies that have highlighted a variety of risk factors, although I will say that the literature on risk factors for methotrexate AKI is somewhat lacking, and what we really need are rigorous, externally validated risk prediction models for methotrexate AKI. In terms of the ones that we do sort of suspect as potentially being related to methotrexate AKI, I like to divide them up into treatment-related factors as well as patient-specific factors. We know that patients who receive higher doses are at higher risk for methotrexate AKI, patients that have low urine pH, and do not sort of hit that threshold of at least 7.5, which is kind of where we target the urine pH. Volume depletion is a risk factor. Use of certain concomitant medications, such as nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, sulfa drugs, penicillins, and proton pump inhibitors. And then patients who have evidence of third spacing. So what we mean by that are patients that have evidence of pleural effusions or ascites. Methotrexate can actually accumulate in those spaces and lead to higher concentrations. And then there are patient-specific risk factors, and I suspect none of these are particularly surprising, but older age, having diabetes mellitus, having underlying chronic kidney disease. Those are all risk factors. And there's now accumulating evidence that suggests that there may be a genetic predispositions with these underlying mutations in MRP2, which may actually be lead to sort of an inability to efficiently clear methotrexate from the circulation. In terms of the mainstay right now, or at least until recently, for the prevention and treatment of methotrexate AKI, it's really revolved around prevention with urinary alkalinization, with serial monitoring of the serum and urine pH. As I mentioned, we really try to hit that target of at least like 7 to 7.5 for the urine pH. And we often flood these patients with isotonic bicarbonate through the IV and PO bicarbonate tablets as well. Leucovorin is a rescue therapy that can be administered in a number of different ways, orally, IM, or IV. It's basically a derivative of folic acid, and it allows purine and pyrimidine synthesis to occur in the presence of methotrexate. So it basically rescues cells from toxicity that way. The key is that it really needs to be given early to prevent methotrexate toxicity, usually like within 24 hours. And we often dose it according to nomograms like this one. Now, it's the issue with leucovorin, however, is that it tends to be less effective in patients with really, really high methotrexate levels. And so, the question becomes, what are potentially some other options for treatments for patients who develop methotrexate AKI? And so in comes glucarpidase. So glucarpidase is a recombinant bacterial enzyme that very rapidly and effectively cleaves methotrexate to inactive metabolites. It essentially clears like 98% of methotrexate from the circulation in under 15 minutes. This is a nice graph from one of Dr. Bridget Weidman's papers. She's done a lot of really important research in this field. And basically, what her group showed was that in these patients who received high-dose methotrexate, 75 patients, they received glucarpidase, and you can see how quickly and rapidly those methotrexate levels fall soon after administration. In terms of treatment strategies, this is just a nice schematic that really shows where and how leucovorin and glucarpidase actually act, because I think that's really important when we kind of think about how these drugs work. So basically, we know that accumulated methotrexate in the plasma enters cells, it inhibits the dihydrofolate reductase, impairs DNA synthesis, and then glucarpidase very rapidly, lowers methotrexate concentration. It essentially cleaves methotrexate into these two non-cytotoxic metabolites, DAMPA and glutamate, and then these are eliminated primarily by the liver and not by the kidney, and that reduces its toxic effects. Leucovorin can rescue DNA synthesis by bypassing essentially the action of dihydrofolate reductase, and so that just sort of gives you a little bit of an insight into how and where these drugs actually act. Now, in terms of sort of the clinical data that we actually have about the efficacy of glucarpidase until recently, this slide essentially summarizes the key efficacy outcomes from four open-label multicenter compassionate use studies that basically led to the approval of glucarpidase. And the patients that were enrolled in these studies, they all had delayed methotrexate elimination due to kidney dysfunction. And the primary endpoint in all the studies was defined as a clinically important reduction in methotrexate concentration based on methotrexate data. And patients were considered to have achieved this clinically important reduction if all of the plasma methotrexate concentrations after the first dose were less than or equal to 1 micromolar. The outcomes were consistent across all the studies, which is great, but it is important to recognize that these studies were relatively small, heterogeneous study populations, often mixing both pediatric and adult patients, and they often lacked a control group, which really sort of limits our ability to really think clinically about how effective these drugs are. This slide just highlights, that there is potentially a benefit to administering glucarpidase early. And this makes sense. Once a patient has potentially irreversible organ injury, it's unlikely that giving glucarpidase may actually help. So the optimal time frame is probably somewhere between 48 to 60 hours based on some of these initial studies. And this study basically showed that when this optimal time window for administration is adhered to, that there is a reduction in the incidence of grade four toxicity and mortality compared to when glucocorticoids is used outside of this time window. Now, as I've sort of alluded to, the problem again with a lot of these studies is that despite its potent biochemical effects and the fact that, it really rapidly reduces methotrexate concentrations, that speaks more to its biochemical efficacy and less to its clinical efficacy. And so, until recently, there was really no study that had really rigorously examined whether glucocorticoids actually improves clinical outcomes in patients with methotrexate toxicity. And so, what this has led to is considerable interhospital variation in the use of glucocorticoids, where some centers might use it all the time, others might never use it. And this has also led to somewhat conflicting guidelines on who should and should not be even treated with glucocorticoids. This is an example of guidelines that were drawn up in 2018 by a task force that basically outlined which patients might benefit from glucocorticoids by defining these absolute methotrexate concentrations that essentially put patients at higher risk for severe or life-threatening toxicities at specific time points after starting methotrexate. And I won't go through all these thresholds, but this is, potentially a useful tool. Although, I will push back that, it's not clear that some of these thresholds are necessarily backed by strong evidence. And so this begs another question, which is, can we actually use data from observational studies potentially to assess the effects of treatments like glucocorticoids on methotrexate AKI, particularly when we don't have data from rigorous randomized clinical trials? And I think the answer is yes. And we've done this now several times. We've used this method called target trial emulation, which is basically a form of causal inference. We learn from the best that Dr. Miguel Hernan, who's a world-famous epidemiologist and statistician at the Harvard School of Public Health, he essentially pioneered much of this target trial emulation, which we actually implemented during the COVID-19 pandemic. We conducted all these studies using observational data before we even had data from randomized clinical trials to look at whether certain treatments reduce mortality in critically ill patients with COVID-19. And what was really neat is that we sort of came up with the right answer before a lot of these trials were published and came out. And so I think when done correctly, they can be really valuable. And so, there are a couple of key principles when you're conducting this hypothetical target trial, which is that you use very rigorous eligibility criteria as if you were conducting a real randomized clinical trial. You ensure that you use the same time zero or starting point for both groups in order to avoid immortal time bias. You rigorously adjust for baseline confounders, essentially emulating a random treatment assignment. And you analyze patients according to an intention to treat principle, whereby, regardless of this potential for crossover later on, you analyze patients according to the group to which they were initially assigned. And so that is precisely what we did. We conducted a multicenter study of glucocorticoids for high-dose methotrexate AKI. This was truly a Herculean effort where we collected data over the course of 4 or 5 years from patients who were treated at 28 cancer centers across the US from 2000 to 2022. We specifically included adults who received high-dose methotrexate and developed methotrexate AKI, which we essentially defined as a greater than or equal to 1.5-fold rise in the serum creatinine from the pre-methotrexate baseline or the need for dialysis. And we categorized patients according to whether they did or did not get glucocorticoids in the first 4 days following initiation of the methotrexate. And so this is basically just a flow diagram that shows the number of patients that we ended up with in each group. So we had 209 patients who received glucocorticoids and 409 who did not. Just to give you a little bit of background, so we conducted again the sequential target trial emulation framework. And basically, just what that means in simple terms is we categorize patients into either the glucocorticoids treated group or the non-glucocorticoids treated group on each of the 4 days following methotrexate initiation. And basically, what this approach does is it allows for patients to be included in an individual target trial only if they're eligible on that particular day. and you therefore adjust for potential confounders up to and including the day of treatment assignment. And our primary outcome was kidney recovery at hospital discharge. And we collected a lot of really granular data, as you can see here. And it took our collaborators more than an hour to enter data on each patient. That was sort of the extent of how granular this data was. And the reason for that was that we really wanted to make sure that we were adequately adjusting for as many relevant confounders as possible. Now, we also conducted a number of sensitivity analyses. Basically, we wanted to look at whether our results held true, even when we sort of limited our analyses to certain groups, like patients who were receiving glucocorticoids in the first 3 days following methotrexate. We looked at site differences. We also looked at the likelihood of prescribing glucocorticoids by each center. We also looked at treatment after glucocorticoids was officially approved in 2012. We looked at shorter durations of the infusion, and we looked at people that received at least the recommended dose of 50 units per kilogram. And this is just a schematic that basically shows the timeline of our target trial. And basically, it shows how day zero was defined as the period spanning from methotrexate initiation to the following midnight. And it shows how we defined each of these 4 days of the target trial. And this is a really detailed flow diagram that shows how we included patients on each of these individual target trial days. And so it just highlights how rigorous we were about inclusion and exclusion, such that a patient could be included on day one, but not day two, and vice versa. So this is just a summary of some of the key baseline characteristics. And you can see here that patients treated versus not treated with glucocorticoids were similar with respect to age, sex, and race. They were also similar with respect to duration and dose of methotrexate infusion and most baseline laboratory values. But glucocorticoids-treated patients were more likely to have some of these important comorbidities, like hypertension and diabetes. They were more likely to have received concomitant nephrotoxins and more likely to have severe AKI. And so again, this is really important because it just shows that glucocorticoids-treated patients are sicker. And if you don't adjust for these things, then you're not going to sort of notice that benefit for the drug. This schematic basically shows plasma methotrexate levels and severity of AKI in the two groups. And glucocorticoids-treated patients had higher 24, 36, and 48-hour plasma methotrexate concentrations. They also had greater severity of AKI compared to the non-glucocorticoids-treated patients. We also looked at the distribution of timing of glucocorticoids, and you can see that it was essentially administered at a median of 54 hours. And there were no patients that got it beyond 96 hours. We also looked at the distribution of the glucocorticoids dose, and not surprisingly, the median dose was, in fact, sort of this recommended dose of 50 units per kilogram. We also, just as a side note, looked at glucocorticoids-associated adverse events, and they were extremely uncommon, and included relatively mild things like nausea. So, to come to sort of the meat of our findings, in terms of glucocorticoids and kidney recovery, we found in our primary outcome that patients treated with glucocorticoids had a higher adjusted odds of kidney recovery compared to those not treated. And although it wasn't significant, the odds of kidney recovery did appear to be higher among those patients with more severe AKI. And so this just shows that, particularly in those patients who have more severe stage two, stage three AKI, they're more likely to potentially benefit. We also looked at time to kidney recovery, and patients who were treated with glucocorticoids had a faster time to kidney recovery compared to those patients that were not treated with glucocorticoids. Now, also of importance, we wanted to look at other sort of extrarenal outcomes, and we found that patients who were treated with glucocorticoids had a lower adjusted odds of grade two or higher neutropenia, a lower adjusted odds of grade two or higher transaminitis. There was no difference in mucositis between groups. And there did not appear to be any mortality benefit with glucarpitase. And so what does all of this mean? I think for one, we probably need to re-examine some of the existing algorithms that rely on somewhat arbitrarily defined cutoffs for recommending glucarpitase. And we also need some more data to understand whether patients with methotrexate levels that are more modestly supratherapeutic, whether they might benefit from glucarpitase as well. Now, you all may be familiar with this. This is this calculator that's basically available online. It's designed to help clinicians understand the pharmacokinetics of high-dose methotrexate. It basically uses this pharmacokinetic model to display the concentration versus the time curve for a specific patient given a specific methotrexate dosing. And it's kind of overlaid on the population predicted curve for that dose. And this model is actually informed by data from like thousands upon thousands of patients. So this can be a useful adjunctive tool if you're sort of trying to understand a patient's risk. So with that, I want to say thank you very much for the invitation to talk about some of our recent work. I want to say thank you to Dr. David Leaf, who is my co-PI on our glucarpitase study, the collaborators at all of the 28 sites, my lab and team. Also founded the American Society of Onconephrology in 2021 to really kind of further research in this sphere. And then my husband and two daughters, including my oldest daughter, who's 5, and she says she wants to be a kidney doctor. So thank you very much.
Next, Dr. Gupta presents a case of an older patient with methotrexate-associated acute kidney injury. Dr. Nakoda and Dr. Gupta discuss the management of this patient.
So this is a case of a 75-year-old gentleman who was diagnosed with CNS lymphoma. He was admitted for induction treatment with high-dose methotrexate at 8 grams per meter squared administered over 4 hours. His medical history was notable for diabetes mellitus, hypertension, and stage 3A chronic kidney disease. He did receive intravenous fluids appropriately in the form of sodium bicarbonate prior to starting the methotrexate, but his urine pH just prior to starting the methotrexate was only 6.5. He ultimately received high-dose methotrexate on day 2 of his hospitalization. His 24-hour methotrexate level was noted to be elevated to 60, and his creatinine rose from a baseline of 1.1 milligrams per deciliter to 1.8 milligrams per deciliter. This prompted the leucovorin rescue, according to the leucovorin nomogram that I showed you. His 36-hour methotrexate level, however, remained elevated, and his creatinine had now risen to 2.2, but he remained non-oliguric and was therefore making urine. And so the question for you is, what would be your next step in managing this patient's methotrexate-associated AKI and delayed methotrexate clearance? Wonderful. So it seems like 83% of people agree that administering glucarpitase now, in addition to ongoing leucovorin nebulization of fluids, may be appropriate. So this will be a nice segue to a couple of discussion questions. And I will also turn it over to our panelists and participants as well to discuss. So how do you recognize and confirm delayed methotrexate clearance in clinical practice? What are some of this patient's risk factors for AKI? How should we be managing the AKI? Discuss some of your own experience using leucovorin rescue and delayed methotrexate elimination in older patients, including some of the key limitations. Also logistically, who is in charge of managing a patient's kidney injury in the hospital? How do we decide when and whether to even give glucarpitase? And would you treat with glucarpitase even if a patient's methotrexate levels do not meet the thresholds for treatment? And how do you manage and monitor patients after glucarpitase administration? And what are your criteria for recovery? So maybe just coming back to some of these questions, Dr. Nakoda and Anita would love to hear some of your thoughts about any of these questions.
Yeah, I think just to start off with the kind of introduction about the patient, he is elderly, he was 75, he had some pretty significant comorbidities, including some baseline CKD. So I'll often look at a patient's creatinine clearance, determine if they're eligible to even receive methotrexate, high-dose methotrexate. And Typically, for patients who have, a borderline creatinine clearance, I'll usually reduce their methotrexate dose. So I would be a little wary to give this patient 8 grams per meter squared. I would probably do a lower dose. And there's some data looking at, even 2 to 4 grams per meter squared, which is really effective. So I think that's one thing is just looking at some of those risk factors. That's something I'd really consider about. And this patient who clearly needed it, he has primary CNS lymphoma, methotrexate's the backbone of therapy. I would also say, kind of getting the hospital aware that he has risk factors, and this is one of the more challenging cases to kind of prepare for, close monitoring, being really proactive about the fluid status, urine pH. I think his urine pH was only 6.5. So these patients, I always tell them before they even come to the hospital for their admission, you have to be urine alkalized because you might be waiting to get between getting all these extra fluids and then delaying the start of methotrexate while we wait for your urine to get appropriately alkalized. You're wasting a day and getting all this unnecessary fluid. So I'll often give my patients sodium bicarb before they even come in to ensure they're adequately alkalized, encouraging hydration and things like that. So I'll pause there. Anita, what about you?
Yeah, that was one of the things that really stood out to me, that urine pH before starting wasn't where, it should optimally be. So, giving sodium bicarb and getting the patient to the goal before starting methotrexate would keep the risk a little bit lower, especially given that chronic CKD. And then of course his age put him at risk. Having a lymphoma put him at risk. So, those things. And then the other thing that I wanted to answer here is who is principally in charge of managing patients with methotrexate AKI in the hospital? And I think that's everyone. It's a team effort. The nurses are the ones that are at the bedside and may notice something before someone else does, and by all means should notify the providers. And then, of course, those who are reviewing the chart and seeing the lab results or seeing the trend of how the creatinine clearance is, or even something else in the patient that has changed. Everybody involved is involved in principle, like managing issues like this.
Yeah, those are all really, really great points. One thing I wanted to mention about the underlying CKD. So I do think getting a really sort of clear understanding of what a patient's baseline kidney function is actually very challenging. I deliberately sort of kept the CKD piece vague here because this patient, we might have actually benefited from having a cystatin C, for example. We know that in these patients with cancer, we're often overestimating their kidney function with creatinine. And so perhaps we should be thinking about trying to be more creative and in integrating some of these cystatin C-based measurements so that we can really kind of understand the baseline kidney function. And also, in terms of the AKI, it's really interesting to hear your all's perspective because, yeah, we don't see these patients really until they have AKI. And so kind of understanding what leads up to the event, it's almost like a little bit of detective work for us. We're also lucky that we have access to glucocorticoids, and I know that may or may not necessarily be the case at other centers, but we are pretty proactive about trying to give glucocorticoids early in these patients as soon as they're sort of showing signs of kidney injury, because I do sort of anecdotally feel, even though our data didn't necessarily sort of support this, anecdotally we feel that the earlier the patients get it, the better, at least within the first 60 hours, for instance.
Yeah, Dr. Gupta, I completely agree. The saying that time is money, I always say time is kidney. We shouldn't wait to for the methotrexate level to continue to rise past the limits it should, at that 48-hour mark or 72-hour mark before we say maybe it's time for glucocorticoids. Early on, if we feel like we're things are looking that way, that's when we would use the mtxpk.org and sort of trend the curve and see potentially where this patient would be in 24 hours. And if it's looking like they need it, then we should give it sooner.
Yeah, I think the mtxpk.org tool is really underutilized. I don't know if the two of you have had this experience of kind of introducing it to your colleagues and things more frequently. But I think it's such a helpful tool because I think to what Dr. Gupta was alluding to, creatinine is not sometimes the whole story of what someone's metabolism is going to be, their renal clearance is going to be. And so I think it really kind of helps offset some of that information and make a decision based on those curves. And in the next case, I think we'll talk about that too. But I do think the decision to start glucocorticoids can be challenging because of the cost. Leucovorin is very easy and pretty cheap in relatively. So that's something that I think is quite easy to adjust and increase the leucovorin dose. There's some caveats to that, but generally the data has shown that even higher doses is super safe and isn't really much of a risk in terms of impacting efficacy. I think sometimes that decision to pull the trigger on glucocorticoids sometimes does require administrative discussions, which sometimes could take 24 or 48 hours. So I think it's really helpful to have glucocorticoids on board and start those discussions early too, because I think as both of you said, it's so critical that we give it early. And I also tell my colleagues that something that I don't think I realized about glucocorticoids is that the typical way that we monitor glucocorticoids after administration is with an immunoassay. We actually don't have a methotrexate done in-house, even though I'm at a big cancer center. We send it out to a lab that does the immunoassay. We don't have access to HPLC, which is the high-performance liquid chromatography, which is the preferred way of monitoring methotrexate levels after you've received glucocorticoids, because the immunoassay actually still detects the metabolite DAMPA, so it can kind of look like the levels are still high even though the patients are responding. And that's not something that most people have access to. Sending it out to Mayo or some of these big labs can be logistically challenging, especially in a stressful inpatient unit. So I kind of warn my colleagues that even if you don't have access to that, that kind of different way of checking the methotrexate levels, try to do it, but just keep that in mind that we almost always the methotrexate levels come down really nicely. But we should still keep checking these levels because sometimes people may have a little bit of a rebound. There's some data that show that too. I don't think it's the most clinically relevant issue for the majority of patients about that rebound, but it's still important to keep checking methotrexate levels afterwards.
Absolutely. We actually do not have easy access to HPLC levels as well. So that I think that is one of the limitations. One of the things I will say about cost is there was a study that actually looked at sort of the cost sort of barriers with glucocorticoids and versus actually the cost of a prolonged hospitalization if a patient has severe AKI and doesn't get glucocorticoids. And actually the potentially prolonged hospitalization ends up costing more. So that's sort of one interesting kind of tidbit to always consider, and the cost of obviously like performing dialysis, for instance, instead can sometimes be can be a lot. So let me segue now to the follow-up of this particular patient. So at hour 48, we did make the decision to give him a single dose of glucocorticoids at 50 units per kilo, along with a leucovorin per protocol and isotonic bicarbonate. And we were able to bring his pH up to 7, and it stayed that way. His creatinine peaked at 3.3, but it did ultimately plateau and it downtrended to close to his baseline, not quite his baseline, but 1.5 by discharge on day 14.
In the next segment, Dr. Nakoda presents a case of a younger patient with methotrexate-associated kidney injury. Nurse Varghese and Dr. Nakoda discuss rechallenging a patient with methotrexate.
So I'll present the next case. The next case I wanted to talk about was a patient who was younger, receiving high-dose methotrexate as part of a more intensive chemo regimen. So this is a 28-year-old gentleman. He has a history of dwarfism, who was diagnosed with Burkitt lymphoma. He had bone marrow and central nervous system involvement, so a particularly high-risk form of Burkitt lymphoma. His blood work showed severe cytopenias when he first presented, with a hemoglobin of 7, platelets were 4, and white blood cell count of 7.1. So really quite sick on presentation. His bone marrow confirmed nearly complete marrow involvement by lymphoma. On exam, he had a cranial nerve 3 palsy, and we confirmed central nervous system involvement based on imaging, as well as a lumbar puncture using flow cytometry and cytology. And the patient had received hyper-CVAD. It was a pretty intense regimen for the patient, but he tolerated it and initially had a complete response on his first course of therapy, but unfortunately had CNS relapse within 9 months. For those of you who treat Burkitt lymphoma, this is unfortunately not an uncommon situation in patients with CNS lymphoma because it's often hard to optimize both the neurologic disease with CNS penetrating disease as well as the typical preferred regimens for systemic disease. So he unfortunately relapsed within 9 months and got a regimen called Matrix. For those of you who may not have used this regimen before, it includes methotrexate, which is about 3.5 grams given over about 3 or 4 hours. Cytarabine, thiotepa, and rituximab. And as part of the regimen, the standard protocol is to also give leucovorin starting at 24 hours after the methotrexate, and of course, all the other supportive interventions like urine alkalization. When the patient arrived for his first cycle, he was really quite deconditioned. He had profound progression of his neurologic symptoms. His performance status was very poor. And in just a matter of a few weeks, he had become quite sick. He was otherwise, besides this, had few comorbidities, was actually quite healthy. He had normal vital signs. His blood work didn't show anything particularly concerning. And he had been appropriately started on sodium bicarbonate, and his urine was appropriately alkalized. But unfortunately, his course was complicated by altered mental status, fevers, rash, arthralgias. And this started about 8 hours after he started the cytarabine. And this was 36 hours after he started the methotrexate. And so the way the treatment regimen is given, you get the methotrexate first, and then starting the next day, you receive the other medications, the chemotherapy. And so I just currently wanted to show you what his curves look like. As you can see here, his methotrexate levels were was quite high. We had actually done an early methotrexate level. We got it 18 hours. At our institution, we're not able to kind of get a methotrexate at any hour result in a timely fashion. So they usually send batch the sending the labs at the same time. And so we checked with AM labs, and it ended up being at around 18 hours, which is why I have a level there. We also had a 36-hour level, which was also elevated. So at 18 hours, it was 350. At 36 hours, it was 59 micromole. And you can see this correlates with a clear acute kidney injury. And so our savvy pharmacist and I worked together to put this data into the mtxpk.org. And I wanted to just show you this because I think it's helpful. The first time I pulled up the tool, it actually is quite intuitive once you use it a couple times, but it can be a little intimidating when you're, in a busy inpatient unit. But basically, what you do is you put in you can put in a patient identifier, so it's easy to come back to that in the future. And then you put in their age, some of their weight, and so that we can calculate the body surface area, so height and weight. And then you can put in some information about how the methotrexate is given and duration of therapy and the dose and things like that. And then it really maps this out for you. What I think is really helpful with this tool is it actually shows you what their predicted clearance should be ideally. And if they're not really lining up with that predicted clearance, that is a good indication that they probably would benefit from glucocorticoids. And so the blue diamonds are actually representing the cutoff values for consensus guidelines. And I think this is really helpful because not everybody has labs collected perfectly at those specific time points that we use, that the guidelines often recommend. And so sometimes that can be helpful when someone's kind of borderline in terms of benefiting. And so I think this is just a fantastic tool. So we use this tool for our patient. Let's start with the first question. For this young adult patient receiving high-dose methotrexate with intensive chemotherapy, how would you most commonly integrate methotrexate monitoring and rescue in your practice? So for this patient, would you do standard methotrexate level monitoring with a protocol-based leucovorin rescue only? Would you intensify the methotrexate level monitoring? Would you check more frequently and then escalate the leucovorin based on these trends? And would you proactively use aggressive hydration, urinary alkalization with protocol-based rescue, or would you consider early glucocorticoids in the setting of rising methotrexate and for anticipated delayed clearance? Yeah, so great. We have a few different answers here. It looks like about half of folks recommended proactively using aggressive hydration and then protocol-based rescue. And in his case, not many probably have the protocol-based rescue available, but he actually did meet criteria for glucocorticoids based on his clearance curves. And so I would argue that the majority of you chose the right answer, and that would be giving the glucocorticoids based on the protocol. So, I think his case was a great example of some of the challenges with these really intense chemo regimens. It's often not simply just the methotrexate. They have other comorbidities. They have cytopenias. Oftentimes, these other treatments also lead to, let's say, some hepatotoxicity or neurologic issues. Mucositis is a big issue, particularly in the pediatric population, because of the intensity of the chemotherapies. So to highlight a couple unique situations for this patient, he had quite extensive bulk of disease at relapse, so we always worry about tumor lysis syndrome. So we had supported him with respuricase and hydration. He also had something we called cytarabine syndrome, which is kind of related to an inflammatory response related to the cytarabine administration. And so we held the cytarabine, thinking maybe that was contributing. And of course, the methotrexate toxicity was our number one concern. So we had increased his leucovorin based on the protocol. We had also given glucocorticoids. Fortunately, we have glucocorticoids in-house, so we're able to give it in a timely manner. And then we were really closely monitoring his ins and outs and kind of encouraging him to ensure it's collecting the urine for us so that we can keep track and keeping a really close eye on his urine pH going forward too. Now, as I said, he's a pretty sick patient who has a very difficult to treat disease. We know methotrexate is kind of the backbone for patients with CNS lymphoma. So I would want to query the group next about whether, this patient had full recoveries of renal function and he's come to you for follow-up. Would you recommend another cycle of high-dose methotrexate? So would you say yes, the benefits outweigh the risk, or no, I wouldn't recommend further methotrexate? Yeah, I think what we ended up doing too. So I will say there's not tons of data about methotrexate retreatment after glucocorticoids, and I think Dr. Gupta alluded to the fact that we need a lot more data in general related to this space. But in a pediatric population, there was some feasibility of this approach. And my personal take on this is really a personalized approach. I think if a patient really has no other good options, it makes a lot of sense to retry, especially if you can find a reversible etiology, like perhaps it was an issue related to they lost their IV and they weren't able to continue with their sodium bicarb infusion, or perhaps they were on another medication that was causing renal dysfunction and contributing that could be discontinued. And there is some data that they don't often necessarily even need glucocorticoids in the subsequent cycle, especially if you do dose reduction of the methotrexate. Of course, if they have other good options that they could try, we know that for patients with CNS lymphoma, there's good data for CAR T, maybe radiation, a BTK inhibitor. You could consider switching them too. So that's kind of how I thought about this patient. He needed additional debulking with the methotrexate, so we did give him another cycle of methotrexate, and he had actually done okay with that. And then, Dr. Gupta, not to steal your thunder, this is from your paper, and I just wanted to point this out looking at methotrexate rechallenge from your study amongst the patients who were treated with glucocorticoids, so this is not treated. And I just thought it was kind of interesting to show the rate was about 28% in both. Some factors that were influencing high-dose methotrexate clearance, particularly in the young population, so young adult patients and adolescents. So I think the most important thing I always tell my team is urine output in the first 24 hours needs to be monitored very, very closely because we know that's the most critical period. And it's really important that they have a good IV access, especially for some patients where that might be an issue. And then doing a really close review of their medications to ensure there's no drug interactions. One of the most common ones is NSAIDs, because so many patients end up requiring them for certain symptoms. And I think Dr. Gupta mentioned this too. There's some genetic polymorphisms that have been described that maybe contribute. It's just something we don't usually test routinely, so it's not something we often know beforehand. So with that, I guess we'll jump into some discussion questions. So Anita, maybe I'll start with you. How do you kind of coordinate methotrexate level monitoring, leucovorin rescue, hydration, like all these kind of, there's so much going on with these inpatients when they're getting these intense chemos. How is that kind of logistically done at your institution?
So at my institution, we round together as a primary team. So there's a lot of discussion at the table before we go into the bedside and, speak directly to the patient. Typically we have a physician, a nurse practitioner or PA, and then a PharmD, and we'll look at, the trend of methotrexate clearance. Oftentimes we'll, like you and your PharmD did, plug things into mtxpk.org and see whether or not we should, go ahead and activate our pharmacy friends with the glucarbonase. Of course, we're looking at the leucovorin levels every 24 hours, and then we do these additional checks if we feel like, you know what, it might be helpful to see in 8 hours where we are to make a final decision on if we should give glucarbonase or not. Of course, we continue with hydration and the alkalization of the urine. That's part of our protocol. Even before starting chemo, the urine has to be alkaline. We continue to test that daily until the methotrexate's clear. Leucovorin's also embedded into our protocol. So it's given at a standard dosing, and then at that 24-hour mark, if the methotrexate level is higher than we'd like, but not high enough to give glucarbonase, we'll increase the leucovorin a bit. And so some of those things are sort of happening automatically without our discussing because they're part of our protocol. But other things, of course, we're having active discussions to sort of, like you said, prepare because there's a lot of discussion and a lot of people have to agree to give the glucarbonase before it can be given.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question I kind of wanted to ask you, since Anita, you have so much experience with the inpatient unit and Dr. Gupta, have you seen benefits or indications where people have been using glucarbonase for other etiology for other toxicities like mucositis, hepatotoxicity, neurotoxicity?
So definitely we look at the patient as sort of as a whole and look to see what their risks are and if they're experiencing any of these additional complications. So they're definitely those things are considered when we decide to give it. I would like to just touch a little bit on what you were discussing about whether or not that there's a benefit of giving the glucarbonase and then rechallenging. And I think that's a huge factor for us when we give glucarbonase. We, like I said earlier, we want to give it in order to save the kidneys and of course to hopefully reduce the length of stay for the patient and the cost, the hospital cost. But also, for particularly for me working with lymphoma patients, methotrexate is often a first line treatment for them. It's their best treatment option. And so we want to give them the best chance to receive that, to achieve that CR. And in order to do that, that would be ideally receiving the 5 or 6 cycles of methotrexate that we initially plan for them. And oftentimes that means giving them the glucarbonase and allowing them to rechallenge in the subsequent cycles to achieve, our end result of being, free of their cancer. Of course, like you said, sometimes that means dose adjusting. But for the most part, I mean, my clinical experience, I've seen that patients who required glucarbonase that first cycle may not necessarily need it in subsequent cycles.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description. To earn credit for participating in this podcast, Please follow the instructions on how to receive credit information in the episode description.